Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. Why would women want to perform as men? Why is gender crossing so compelling, whether it happens on stage or in everyday life? What can drag performance teach, and what aesthetic, political, and personal questions does it raise? Performance artist Diane Tour has been experimenting with the performance of gender for 30 years, exploring everything from feminist go-go dancing to masculine power play. One of the key pioneers of drag king performance, Tour has been celebrated internationally for her gender transformation workshops, in which she has taught hundreds of ordinary women how to pass as men on city streets around the world. This cultural subterfuge appeals to participants for many different reasons: personal confidence building, sexual frisson, gender subversion, trans curiosity, or simply the appeal of disguise and role play. Sex, Drag, and Male Roles documents the evolution of Tour's work by blending first-person memoir and commentary from Tour with critical reflections and contextualization from leading performance critic Stephen J. Bottoms. The book includes a consideration of the long cultural history of female-to-male cross-dressing and concludes with Tour's do-it-yourself guide to becoming a man for a day. Diane Tour developed her cross-disciplinary art in the downtown New York art scene from 1976 to 2002. Now living in Scotland, Tour has earned an international reputation for her performances and gender transformation workshops, featured on HBO, BBC, and This American Life on NPR, among others. Her work is the focus of a feature film, Man for a Day. Hello, Diane.
Hello.
So, you are an internationally acclaimed performance artist, best known for her performances of male roles. Not merely dressing in male drag, but managing somehow to inhabit the male psyche. Your onstage personas provide audiences new insights on what masculinity is. So, introduce us to a few of your favorite onstage characters, and tell us what you like best about them.
Well, I have several characters. I guess the first one that immediately comes to mind is Jack Spratt. And Jack Spratt, it's, of course, a name which is associated with the nursery rhyme. And I deliberately chose that because this is a man who hasn't really grown up. He's still a boy in his own imagination. But, of course, a lot of men are like that. And I took license in performing Jack Spratt. He's a middle-aged Cockney mod, and his claim to fame is that he knew the Who when they were called the High Numbers, and they used to play in a pub in Shepherd's Bush called Goldhawk. So I'm talking in a Cockney accent like that the whole time. I'm talking about Jack Spratt the whole time. I'm him, I'm talking like that, but when I'm talking as Diane, this is who I am. And so Jack Spratt is a character. He's a singer-songwriter. He has also the capacity to play the blues harp, and he was very much a part of the mod scene in London in the early 60s. And part of the mod scene was about clothes. So he worked in a shoe shop in Carnaby Street in the West End of London, which was the mod street where there were lots of mod shops, and he worked in a shoe shop, Topper's Shoe Shop. And he also was very much affiliated to a gang of mod youth. So they would all get dressed up in their maroon leather coats, and they had particular hairstyles, and they wore hush puppy shoes, and they were extraordinarily sharp in the way that they dressed. Now, all of the material that's ever been written about mods has always been written about men, and it's been written by men. And as I was a mod girl, we weren't called women, we were called girls. I had a very different perspective on mods, and I created this character, Jack Spratt, as a way to express an experience I had of being a mod, but from a woman's perspective, but through the voice of Jack Spratt as a man. So it's been, you know, a lot of fun to perform in, because I also have a couple of songs that I've performed, and these are songs that are nostalgic for me because I was in a band called the DC-10s in New York in 1978, and we used to sing these songs. One of them was How Much Do You Want to Be Rich, and the other one was called, well, we had lots of different songs, but these are the ones that I've adapted to Jack Spratt, How Much Do You Want to Be Rich, and the second one was He Was a Mutant, She Was an Amputee. Jack Spratt also dances wildly about, and he plays the blues harmonica, and he's a real character. I think playing Jack Spratt has given me license to be able to be coarse, you know, to hack and to wipe my nose with the back of my sleeve and to point and to drink beer on stage and to laugh, chortle, if you like, and so it's all these kind of behaviors that as a woman they're not really allowed to. But it's also through this character I'm able to express a part of cultural history which has not been expressed really. So I really enjoy doing that Jack Spratt. That's one of them. And another character is, so I talk with a Cockney accent when I'm Jack Spratt. I'm like talking like that. And when I'm Hamish McAllister, who's this Scottish aficionado of Robert Burns, the Scottish poet, and talking with a Scottish accent like that. And it's very different from talking like the Cockney Jack Spratt. I'm talking about the Burns, Robert Burns poetry, and I'm reciting his poems, and I'm accompanied on stage by a fiddler and also by somebody who plays the bagpipes and a troupe called the Highland Illusion. And the Highland Illusion are this troupe of men dressed as women who do these dances, these Highland dances, and they also sing a lot of body poetry that Burns wrote. Now, many of these poems have been censored through the ages. And as Hamish McAllister, I can access these poems because they were really essentially written by men for men. Again, it was not a world that was open to women. And so I can also access a kind of history, a radical history of Robert Burns. He was very much a Jacobin, a supporter of the anti-monarchists in France. And this is a certain history of Robert Burns, which, you know, which I certainly didn't read at school growing up in Aberdeen in Scotland. So Hamish McAllister gives me access, if you want, to be able to retell history of Robert Burns, and also to, as this man, Hamish McAllister, recite some of Burns's poems, and the poems that you would never hear at a Burns night supper, because it was, I mean, of course, we didn't have pornography in the 18th century, so they would write these body poems, and that's predominantly why the Burns night suppers were male for many years, because the material was considered too profane.
Today it's, you know, easy to think that the gender bending performances that we see in the mainstream media are something new, but really in fact cross-gender performance has a rather deep history, right? Can you talk about some of the performers or performances that preceded you?
I've certainly been inspired by drag queens, and my brother, who died of AIDS in 92, he used to dress up as a woman as we were kids growing up. At every Halloween, he would always put on women's clothes. We didn't think that he was queer. He was just being Donald, but I later, you know, found out he was gay, and he had a lot of friends who were gay, and they used to perform in drag, and it was very different from, you know, I grew up in Aberdeen, and, you know, to have a brother who was gay, it was quite exotic in a sense. I mean, he opened me up to drag, and that, in a way, also opened me up to an experience of drag. Like, when I moved to New York in 1976, there were lots of extraordinary drag queens, well, various people that I met through the 70s and 80s, like Ethel Eichelberger and Sherry Vine and Joey Arias and Anthony Johnson, who had a troupe called the Black Lips. But I also learned through the years a history of women who cross-dressed, like Festa Tilly, women who were vaudeville performers, And then, of course, in Shakespearean times, there were women who cross-dressed who did it for many reasons, principally a way of making money, if you like, because there weren't that many jobs available to women. But if you cross-dressed as a man, then you had access, if you like, to a lot more work opportunities. So many women became sailors, and some also, you know, were in the military, and it was also some became thieves, and, you know, they could occupy the kind of underworld of criminality, if you like, as men, in a way that they couldn't have done as women. And then, of course, there were women like Isabel Eberhardt, who was an equestrian and traveled through North Africa on a horse and became known as this highly acclaimed equestrian, and was dressed as a Muslim man and actually gained access to the Muslim Brotherhood. That was the late 19th century, so early 20th. So I've always been very conscious of cross-dressing as a way to access a kind of netherworld, if you want, or a way of escaping the normality of heterosexuality, and, you know, or I should say heterosexual world, which is the world that we live in. And so as a girl, you know, growing up, it was always very exciting to me to see my brother cross-dressing, and then later on other men and gay theater companies like the Hot Peaches, and performers like Peggy Shaw from Split Butchers. And so, and when I first came to New York, I saw a wonderful performance at the theater in the square called The Club, in which all the parts were played by women, and there were men, male parts and female parts. And that was just stunning to me, you know, arriving from the UK to New York and seeing this extraordinary performance. And so it wasn't unusual that that would be a direction I would go in as a performer, as an area of exploration.
Well, that's really fascinating. So the differences, let's talk about that. So what are the key differences between a male drag, where a man dresses and performs as a woman, and female drag, where a woman dresses and performs as a man? Are there similarities?
Well, I think all drag, you know, it has a great possibility for people. And, you know, there are some people who are more skilled at drag than others. And I should say that the word drag really originated from the idea of a long dress that drags along the ground. So it originated from a kind of idea of men doing drag, men cross-dressing. And it takes a certain amount of skill to be a good drag artist, whether you're a man performing a woman or a woman performing a man. And so I think in terms of performance, I would not be concerned about gender. I'd be concerned about the skill of the performer. But in terms of the audience, not many men really appreciate women performing as men. They feel affronted. Not all of them, of course, but a lot of them do. And somehow men performing as women seem to be kind of titillating and exciting, whereas women performing as men, it's almost iconoclastic, like they've defiled something sacred, that sacred thing being masculinity. And that's, you know, that's just mainly because men are the ones who are the one, and we as women are the other. So it's almost like it's okay to parody a woman, a man performing as a woman, that's considered, you know, kind of titillating and fun, but a woman performing a man is considered somehow an affront. I think we just have to keep developing drag as an art form, and eventually, hopefully, there won't be so much concern about these things.
Your Man for a Day workshops, where women experiment with dressing and acting like men, have attracted a really wide variety of participants. So what do you think it is that people find so compelling about this subject? I mean, can you talk about the reasons that women attend the workshop and what they learn from the experience?
Women who participate have many, many different reasons. Sometimes they're opera singers and they are going to do a performance in a trousers role, you know, a breeches. They're going to perform in breeches. Or another time, It could be that somebody is really interested in performing as a man because they could have this desire to maybe become a man, and they are following that desire by creating a male character for themselves that they maybe have a fantasy about. Other people do it for reasons of titillation, sexual titillation. Maybe afterwards they're going to meet their lover, and that could be a man, it could be a woman. It's not only... a lot of people think women cross-dressing as men is something titillating for women, you know, in a lesbian relationship, which is true, but it's also something that's interesting in, you know, a heterosexual relationship, because it's about role play, if you like. And then there are some people who've done the workshop because they're professional women and they want to learn a kind of behavior that gives you a sense of entitlement or privilege, which is very much in male behavior. So they learn things like to stop smiling all the time, or to stop nodding their head, or to stop using their eyes in a way that's very expressive, or they learn how to take up space, for instance. So I think a lot of women feel that they're not given the space that they deserve. You know, it's very obvious in the subway. You sit in the subway as a woman and you're scrunched up because somebody has spread his legs and he's pushing into your space. So, you know, as women, we're constantly dealing with this, having to adapt to compromise our space, and you know, and that also applies to our voice as well, the way we use our voice. So one of the things I do teach women in the workshop is how to use a voice volume, because it's very essential that as women that we can use that as a form of self-defense, if you like. So there are many, many different reasons that women have taken the workshop over the years, and it varies from country to country. And, you know, like when I did this workshop in New Delhi, for instance, the women there, they are very restricted in what they can do. So for them, just being able to smoke a cigarette on the street was a huge act of freedom, or to go to a discotheque and to dance on the floor of the discotheque carrying a beer bottle. I mean, you know, that to me doesn't mean anything, but to them it was a very big thing, you know, because as women they would never do that in India. And, you know, things just like walking through the streets, you know, going to the bazaar at night, you know, something they wouldn't do as women. So I think performing as men or taking on a male persona gives license to women in many different ways. And I think it gives a lot of women the possibility to be more, to become more than who they are in terms of that narrow definition of what it is to be a woman. And all of it is just behavior. It's learned behavior. Anybody can learn this.
So your book interestingly combines history, original scripts, memoir, and commentary. Readers may be curious to know something about your co-author, Stephen Bottoms. So tell us something about that collaboration and how it influenced the final shape of the book.
I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with Stephen Bottoms. I knew that he had written a book called Playing Underground, and he'd written that with the University of Michigan Press. And Playing Underground basically gave voice to a lot of directors and players who were part of the Greenwich Village theater scene in the 60s, performed at Café Chino and other theaters like that. And I had met him, and we had a very stimulating dialogue about New York and the performance scene there. And he was interested in my experiences because I lived in New York from 1976 to 2002. And during that time, I developed a lot of different performances in places like PS 122 and Franklin Furnace or The Kitchen, and clubs like the Pyramid Club, downtown performance spaces. And I was very active on that scene. And so I had been working on a book, and I proposed to him that we work on this book together because there was a series that, this is a series the University of Michigan Press put out. My friend Annie Sprinkle told me about it, and so he was very keen to work on it. So that's how we started working together. He's a theater historian, but he's also somebody who's a humanist and a feminist, and somebody who I feel really enhanced the book, not just with the questions that he asked me. He has a certain curiosity which is different from mine. I wouldn't have thought of some of the questions that he proposed to me in relation to my work. But he's also somebody who's very astute in terms of history and an excellent scholar. And I feel my work has definitely been very well presented by working with him. And it's been given a context. So, yeah, I feel very fortunate to have had that opportunity.
But I'm kind of curious about this feature film. Man for a Day, is that something that's in development, or can you talk at all about that?
The Man for a Day film is being made by a Berlin filmmaker, Katharina Peters, and she's a colleague and a friend who's known about my work. I've known her since 1982 when I first went to Berlin to perform, and she's always been very interested in my work. The idea to do a Man for a Day film was a way of investigating the concept, so that she worked with women from all different backgrounds and sexualities, and they weren't women who were necessarily interested in the idea of performing as men or taking on a male persona. I think she wanted to find out how it would be for just ordinary women to just try this idea out on them. So one of the women, for instance, is a beauty queen from East Germany. Another woman is a politician from Munich, and she's in the Green Party. Another woman is from Uganda, who is a single mother who had been badly beaten by her husband. Another woman is a Turkish businesswoman. And another woman is a young writer. She's like 20, 21. So it's a very big mixture of people participating in the Man for a Day workshop. And I'm the main protagonist because I'm the workshop leader. And she basically follows them through their lives and how the workshop affects them, or, you know, if it has any lasting effect, if it makes them question ideas about gender and who they are as women, as people. And I think it's going to be a very interesting film. It's not finished yet, but it will be. And it has quite a lot of my history, my performance background in the film itself.
You talked about the workshop and the, you know, the women who, you know, in their culture, they wouldn't be allowed to, you know, dance on a dance floor with a beer, you know, those sorts of things. And it got me thinking about, is there a particular, since you teach this workshop all over, I'm kind of curious, do you have a favorite place that you like to teach this workshop?
Well, you know, it really does depend on the people who participate. And, you know, I've had a wonderful response to my work everywhere. But I think perhaps the place where it's been most of interest has been Germany. And, you know, but I can tell you I've met some extraordinary women, you know, in New York, in Zurich, in Berlin, in Vienna, all over the place where I've taught the workshop. But it's really in Germany where there's been a demand for my work and for this workshop. And in 2002, I was able to make a festival there together with a German colleague, Bridge Markland, who's a performance artist from Berlin. And we made this performance festival there called Go Drag. And it was a one-month-long festival, and it was the opportunity for me to bring all these different performance artists who I'd worked with from Vienna, from Italy, from Switzerland and Scandinavia and New York and England, to bring them all together so that they could meet each other and see each other's work, because a lot of people were working in isolation, and I knew who they were because they had been inviting me to their town and to their theater spaces or whatever. And I, you know, I had the chance to meet them and work with them. And there was, you know, just an extraordinary bunch of women, and I really thought they should meet each other and connect. and have a dialogue, because they're all working with this theme of identity and performing masculinity, performing femininity, performing androgyny, playing with all these different ideas of gender and what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man, and so on and so on. But they were all approaching it from their own perspectives, and all extraordinarily interesting, very exceptional, interesting women. So I think Germany has been very supportive in the sense that, you know, for instance, the help Stadt Kulturfonds in Berlin gave 60,000 euros for us to have this festival. And I've not had that kind of support in New York, for instance. You know, and economics does play a part.
Well, Diane, thank you so much. This has been very interesting. And, you know, congratulations on the book. It's very well done.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Diane Tor, co-author of Sex, Drag, and Male Roles, Investigating Gender as Performance. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.